Have you ever skipped a workout and, told yourself it was just because you slept poorly the night before? Or maybe you snapped at a coworker and chalked it up to having a really stressful morning?
Oh, yeah. We do this constantly. I mean, we construct these very comforting narratives to explain our behavior,
Right.
right?
And if you are like most people listening to this, you probably gave yourself a perfectly logical explanation for those actions. But here is the real question for you to consider today. Was that explanation actually a valid excuse? Or did you just pull the wool over your own eyes?
And we really do sleep soundly at night, believing those narratives, like completely absolve us of any responsibility. It's wild.
It really is. So welcome to this deep dive. Today, our mission is to explore the writings of Dr. Purnendu Nath, who is widely known to his readers as Puro.
Yeah, Puro has spent over a decade writing, I think it's more than 160 articles now, building this whole philosophy around discipline.
Exactly. And it's all anchored by this one profound idea that, quote, the refusal to think is evil. So today, we are unpacking his article titled Reasons and Excuses. We're looking at that really subtle, invisible, and honestly dangerous distinction between simply explaining an action and truly justifying it.
Yeah, because that distinction isn't just a matter of semantics. Puro points out that confusing these two concepts, it fundamentally corrodes our progress in life.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, a reason simply explains an action. It gives you the mechanics of what occurred. But an excuse, however, is much heavier. It actually forgives or justifies the action because it holds up under, like, intense moral and logical scrutiny.
Let's try to visualize this for everyone because it is a tricky line to walk. Think of a reason as an autopsy. An autopsy just tells you what happened, right? The cause of death.
Right. Just the facts.
Exactly. An excuse, on the other hand, is more like a royal pardon. It tells you why you are entirely forgiven for what happened. And the trap we fall into is that we are constantly handing ourselves royal pardons when really all we've done is perform an autopsy.
That is such a great analogy. It gets right to the heart of the problem. And, language itself is actually partly to blame here.
How so? Like, just the way we speak.
Yeah, exactly. English naturally blurs these two words. We treat them as interchangeable in everyday conversation. If you look at other languages, you often find very distinct, separate words for a mechanical explanation versus a moral justification.
Oh, wow. I never thought about that.
Yeah, so because English allows us to just swap them out, it creates this very subtle but pervasive intellectual dishonesty. We hand over the autopsy report and say, see? I'm pardoned.
So our vocabulary is practically setting us up to fail from the start. But language is just the outer layer, isn't it? If we dig deeper into Puro's work, it becomes clear that we are biologically wired to deceive ourselves this way.
Oh, absolutely. Language is just the symptom. If we look at the neuroscience and human evolution behind this, we find what Puro calls the unholy trinity.
The unholy trinity. That sounds intense. What is that?
Well, these are our primal biological drives. Number one is to avoid pain. Number two is to seek pleasure. And number three, which is crucial here, is to conserve energy. Every single species shares these drives because they are literally the foundation of survival.
I want to focus on that third one for a second, conserving energy,
Yeah.
because that really seems to be the linchpin in how we deceive ourselves.
That really is.
Puro maps out this very specific two-stage failure process that happens in our daily decision-making. So stage one is the action itself, right? You choose a suboptimal path.
Yeah, like you eat the junk food to get that immediate pleasure, or you skip the workout to, avoid the short-term pain of exertion.
Right. Which brings us to stage two, the exact moment the self-deception locks in, finding a real excuse, like a true mathematically and morally sound justification that requires rigorous high-energy thinking.
Exactly. And your brain's third primal drive recognizes that mental effort as an expensive calorie burn. So it actively avoids the heavy lifting.
It just wants to be lazy.
Pretty much. Instead, it prompts you to settle for a flimsy reason. Your brain essentially whispers, why burn the calories analyzing this? Just say you were tired. That's good enough.
It's literally a biological shortcut. And we get trained to accept these shortcuts incredibly early in life. I mean, think about the last time a child asked you why for the fifth consecutive time.
Oh, yeah. The endless why phase.
Did you give them a philosophically sound justification, or did you just say, because I said so, or because we have to go, just to save your own energy?
We all do it. I mean, hurried, stressed parents give logically weak reasons, and the child, who is also biologically driven to conserve energy, just accepts that flimsy explanation rather than challenging it further.
So they learn that weak reasons are perfectly fine.
Exactly. Over time, this normalizes the use of weak justifications. We are conditioned from childhood to accept the flimsy reason as if it were a valid excuse.
So we are fighting our childhood conditioning, sure. But Kuru also frames this as a fundamental evolutionary mismatch in our actual brain structure, doesn't he?
He does. He highlights the tension between two completely different operating systems in the brain. On one hand, you have the amygdala, our primitive brain.
The lizard brain, basically.
Right. It is built for survival, speed, and binary thinking. You know, black or white, fight or flight. And crucially, it consumes very little energy.
Yeah, and the other system.
On the other hand, you have the prefrontal cortex. This is the modern analytical brain. It's capable of nuanced spectrum thinking, but it is incredibly slow, and it is a massive energy hog.
But wait, I look at it this way, though. That energy efficiency of the amygdala isn't a glitch. It's a highly optimized feature. I mean, if a tiger is chasing you, you don't want to use spectrum thinking to analyze its childhood trauma, right?
No, definitely not.
You just want the binary signal to run. So isn't it completely natural that our brains default to these fast, low-energy shortcuts for everyday decisions?
It is entirely natural, and Peru totally acknowledges that survival required those fast binary shortcuts. The mismatch happens because the environment changed way faster than our biology.
Oh, I see. We don't live in the jungle anymore.
Exactly. We're applying a physical survival feature to modern moral and intellectual dilemmas. Evolution gave us the amygdala's speed to survive, but true human progress in a complex society demands depth.
You cannot thrive today by relying on the energy-saving mechanisms of a caveman.
You really can't. You have to willingly expend the energy to use the prefrontal cortex. This is exactly why Puru states that the refusal to think is evil, because it actively robs you of your potential by keeping you in basic survival mode.
That makes so much sense. And if we take that a step further, the implications get pretty massive. I mean, if our individual brains are constantly tricking us to conserve energy, what happens when millions of brains do this simultaneously?
The macro level.
Yeah, Puru takes this exact framework and applies it to massive societal structures. But before we get into that, I want to make a really quick impartiality disclaimer.
Oh, yes, very important.
Just to be super clear with you listening, whether you find yourself leaning left, right, or straight down the middle on these next issues, the point here is not to validate a political or social stance.
Totally. We are strictly observing the underlying logic here.
Exactly. We are solely reporting how Puru tests these systems to see if they operate on valid excuses or just convenient low-energy reasons. We aren't endorsing them, just conveying the ideas in the source material.
That is a crucial lens to keep in mind. Yeah, so let's start with how this biological shortcut protects our wallets, or more specifically, corporate wallets.
Yeah, Puru levels a pretty heavy critique at the insurance industry here.
He really does. He argues that corporations prioritize short-term profit while using dishonest representation as their reason to the public. He points to what we casually call health insurance.
And what does he think we should call it?
According to Puru, it should actually be called DAFER. That's D-A-F-E-R. It stands for Disease and Accident Financial Expense Reduction.
DAFER. Wow. That's a mouthful, but it is brutally accurate.
Yeah. By calling it health insurance, the industry is basically handing society a very convenient, low-energy reason to conflate financial coverage with actual physical health.
It allows us to just outsource our well-being to a financial product. We avoid taking personal responsibility for the daily lifestyle choices that generate real health, all while hiding behind the flimsy reason that we are insured.
Which flows directly into his analysis of the medical system itself. I mean, if we are using insurance as a shield, what kind of care are we actually receiving? Puru argues we are being provided sick care, masquerading as health care.
The mechanism of action here is fascinating. The medical system predominantly treats symptoms with magic pills.
Right.
And the reason or justification often cited by the industry is that, well, patients demand easy fixes.
And looking back at the unholy trinity, patients naturally want to avoid the pain of strict lifestyle changes, right? And they want to conserve their energy, so they happily accept the pill.
Because a true healthcare system would demand the incredibly high energy effort of changing how you eat, how you sleep, and how you move to actually cure and prevent the root cause of the disease.
Exactly. Passing the blame to patients who, you know, demand easy fixes is an autopsy. It explains what is happening mechanically, but it is not a valid excuse.
It's not a pardon.
Right. It's not a pardon for a systemic failure that prioritizes managing sickness for profit over cultivating true health.
This biological shortcut doesn't just protect financial systems, though. It also protects our cultural habits. Like, take Puru's critique of Ayurveda, for example.
Yeah, he notes that people often cite ancestral tradition as a reason for their dietary choices, like consuming really high amounts of saturated fats, such as ghee.
Tradition is a very powerful low-energy reason. It feels safe because it's familiar.
But Puru argues that simply citing tradition, without subjecting those practices to modern empirical scientific scrutiny in our current sedentary context, is intellectual dishonesty.
Right. It is a reason, but it is not a valid excuse to continue practices that rigorous science might actually reveal to be harmful today.
And we see that exact same protection of cultural habits with the alcohol industry. Puru points out how health influencers frequently push this concept of moderation. He actually calls it malicious moderation.
Malicious moderation. I'm malicious.
Because it serves as a socially acceptable reason to avoid challenging deep cultural norms around drinking. The rigorous high-energy scientific reality is that the safe limit for alcohol consumption is actually zero.
Wow. But facing that reality is socially uncomfortable.
Extremely. So moderation serves the financial interests of the industry and the social comfort of the individual, but it completely lacks the scientific justification to be a true excuse.
And the scale of this self-deception, it really reaches its peak when Puru applies it to nationalist politics. He writes that right-wing nationalist movements often rely on the creation of a defined enemy.
Yeah, this serves as a reason to instill fear and maintain the status quo or consolidate power.
Because fear is the ultimate low-energy reason, right? It bypasses the prefrontal cortex entirely and speaks directly to the amygdala.
Exactly. It serves as a rationalization for the consolidation of power. But when subjected to rigorous moral and legal scrutiny, it completely lacks the true standing of justice. It explains the mechanics of how power is maintained again, an autopsy, but it is not a valid excuse for infringing on human rights.
When you lay it out like that, from insurance to medicine, diet, culture, and politics, the pattern is just unmistakable. These massive systems are exploiting the exact same biological glitch.
Yep, they offer the public a low-energy reason.
And we, driven by our unholy trinity, accept the autopsy and pretend it's a pardon because demanding a high-energy excuse just requires way too much friction.
Recognizing that collective illusion is a really powerful paradigm shift. But observation without application doesn't actually change anything. The core of Puru's philosophy is what you do once you see the illusion. Like, how do you rewrite your own programming?
Which is where we pivot from theory to the action plan. How do we actually fight back against the amygdala and the systems that exploit it? Puru introduces this behavioral roadmap, starting with a concept he calls Purunoia.
Purunoia, it's essentially a highly tuned state of hypervigilance. It is a healthy, productive level of paranoia regarding the long-term negative consequences of your daily choices.
So instead of an irrational fear of external things, it is an intense internal vigilance aimed at catching your own flimsy justifications in real time.
Exactly. You have to set up mental tripwires for yourself. When you hear your own internal monologue say, oh, I forgot, or I wasn't aware, or when you find yourself pointing the finger at circumstances, that Purunoia has to kick in.
You have to pause and interrogate the origin of that thought.
And the question you must ask in that pause is fundamental. Does this choice originate from courage and strength, or is it stemming from fear and weakness? Are you yielding to the unholy trinity's desire to conserve energy, or are you forcing the prefrontal cortex to engage?
But, you know, it's one thing to know you should engage the prefrontal cortex, but it's another entirely to actually do it when you are exhausted or stressed. There is always a gap between what we know we should do and what we actually execute.
Oh, the implementation gap. Puru talks a lot about this.
Right. How do we close that gap?
Closing it requires understanding the mechanics of neuroplasticity, which Puru frames through the SAID principle, that's S-A-I-D, stands for specific adaptation to imposed demands.
Okay, break that down for us.
It is a foundational concept in human physiology and psychology. It dictates that your body and your mind will adapt specifically to the exact demands you place upon them.
Let's unpack the how of that, because it isn't just a motivational quote, it's actual neuroscience. When you accept a weak reason to skip a workout, neurons fire together in a specific pattern.
Yep. And the myelin sheath around that neural pathway literally thickens, making it physically faster and easier for your brain to choose laziness the next time.
That's terrifying, actually.
It is. But conversely, if you impose the rigorous demand of absolute honesty on yourself, you strengthen the neural pathways associated with executive control and grit.
So if you demand weakness, your mind adapts to be weak. If you demand strength, your mind adapts to be strong.
Exactly. And to force that adaptation, to intentionally build those pathways of strength, Puru advocates for the practice of voluntary hormetic shocks.
Hormetic shocks. Okay, so hormesis is a biological phenomenon where a low dose of a stressor, something that might be toxic or damaging at high doses, actually triggers a beneficial strengthening adaptation in the organism.
Like exercise. Exercise is a classic example. You tear muscle fibers slightly, and the body overcompensates by building them back stronger. Puru suggests we need to apply this directly to our willpower.
I love looking at this as a fire drill for your willpower. By intentionally introducing a controlled stressor when you absolutely do not have to, like, say, taking a freezing cold shower for 60 seconds, you are building a deprivation muscle.
The cold shower is a perfect laboratory for this. When that freezing water hits, your amygdala just screams at you to step out. It is demanding that you avoid pain and seek the pleasure of warmth.
But by staying in the cold water, you are forcing your prefrontal cortex to override the amygdala. You are physically training your brain to handle discomfort.
And the carryover is where the magic happens. By repeatedly proving to yourself that you can handle acute physical discomfort without reaching for a flimsy reason to quit, you change your default setting.
So when real life gets incredibly tough, like a massive project deadline or a really difficult conversation or a sudden crisis, your brain doesn't immediately scramble for an excuse to hide.
Nope. Because you've already built the neurological infrastructure to withstand the friction, you are actively building a culture of intellectual honesty within your own mind.
But relying on memory to track your progress is dangerous, right?
Yep.
Because memory is easily manipulated by the unholy trinity.
Oh, very easily. This is exactly why Puru insists on the daily practice of journaling.
But not just the Dear Diary kind of journaling, right? It has a very specific mechanical purpose in this framework.
Yeah, it functions as an instrument of intellectual humility. When you force yourself to write down your decisions at the end of the day, along with the logic you used to make them, you strip away the fog of rationalization.
You create a tangible, historical record of your thinking. It forces you to look at your autopsy reports and your royal pardons in black and white.
You can physically see the flimsy reasons you relied on that day. And that visibility allows you to course correct. It lets you learn from your own missteps and, crucially, from observing the reasons and excuses operating in the world around you.
Over time, the compounding effect of this daily, rigorous self-auditing turns you into what Puru calls a consistency conqueror.
A consistency conqueror. I love that term.
It really paints a picture of someone who isn't just relying on bursts of motivation, but who has fundamentally rewired their relationship with friction and truth. So where does this ultimately lead?
The ear game.
Yeah. If you apply the S principle, embrace Puranoia, practice hormetic shocks, and journal your logic, what is the end game of all this effort?
The end game is what Pura describes as entering the virtuous spiral to superhuman. The goal of this entire framework isn't just like marginal improvement. The goal is a radical shift in existence, to live a life with absolutely zero invalid reasons.
Zero. That implies stripping away every single layer of self-deception.
It does. As you systematically catch your flimsy reasons and replace them with rigorous, high-energy honesty, you begin to spiral upward. Your baseline for what you tolerate from yourself rises.
Until eventually you reach a state where your deprivation muscle is so strong and your prefrontal cortex is so dominant that you become stronger than even your strongest valid excuses.
That is the turning point. You might have a perfectly valid, mathematically and morally sound excuse for not executing a task. The royal pardon is sitting right there on the table, totally justified, and you refuse to take it.
You execute anyway. That is the superhuman level Puru is talking about.
And that level of execution profoundly shifts how we understand leadership, too. True leadership is rarely about the title on your door or the authority you've been granted. It is demonstrated quietly, over and over, every single time you choose the harder right over the easier wrong.
By systematically conquering your own unholy trinity, you stop contributing to the societal illusions we discussed earlier. You become a walking disruption to the norm of flimsy reasons. And by doing so, you implicitly challenge and invite everyone around you to elevate their own standards.
Which leads to a final, slightly unsettling thought I want to leave you with today. We've spent this time unraveling how deeply woven these low energy reasons are into our neurobiology and the massive institutions that govern our lives.
Yeah.
But try to imagine this hypothetical scenario. If, starting tomorrow morning, human beings completely lost the biological ability to deceive themselves, if we could only act or consume if we possessed a mathematically and morally unassailable excuse, which massive global industries would collapse entirely overnight.
Wow, that is a heavy lens to look through. Which corporate empires, which cultural norms, which political structures are built entirely on our collective willingness to accept an autopsy report and pretend it's a pardon?
It completely changes how you see the world, and more importantly, how you see your own choices within it.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Puru's work. The next time you find yourself skipping that workout, reaching for the junk food, or snapping at a colleague, I want you to pause and pay close attention to the narrative echoing in your head. Ask yourself the hard question, is this an autopsy, or am I trying to hand myself a royal pardon? Start actively observing the reasons and excuses operating in your own life today. We will see you next time.